Well, hey everybody, welcome to MEC. I don't know if you've ever witnessed something that you've seen, it feels like a thousand times, but for whatever reason, this time when you see it, it just sticks with you. I had that happen to me a while back. I was in a restaurant with my wife, and near us was a family of four sitting around a table. None of them were talking to each other. I mean, at all. In fact, the daughter was on her cell phone and had her earbuds on. And she was actually turned physically away from her mom and dad and brother, just making it as clear as possible with her body language. I don't want to be here. I don't want to interact with you. I'm just going to endure this. I couldn't help but just watch this family. And I kid you not, the whole time we were there, I never saw them speak to each other once. The whole time. They just seemed, as I said, to be enduring each other, enduring the moment, just waiting for it to end. And, you know, I couldn't help but have my mind start to wander. What kind of family life are they having? I mean, would this be considered a close family? A family that's functional? If they're here out together for a meal, and not only are they not talking to each other, but the parents are letting one of those kids completely divorce herself from interaction with the rest of the family by, you know, allowing her to keep those buds in. What kind of separation is going on at home? They're not talking here. They're not going to be talking there. The parents are probably isolated from their kids' world. The kids are pretty obvious. They want nothing to do with their parents' world. I just looked at that. And I just, it was like a tragedy. I mean, I almost felt like getting up from my meal and walking over to the table and saying, "Hi, my name's Jim. You don't know me, but I'd love to sit and talk with you." Because there's obviously there's a breakdown here. There's one thing all family researchers agree on. It's that communication is the foundation for family life. Communication is. It's the foundation for relationships. It's the foundation for community. It's the foundation for intimacy. We're in a series on how to do family, and today we're going to dig into how families are supposed to communicate with each other. And we desperately need this. In a day of smartphones and texting and apps like Snapchat and Whisper, family communication is like becoming this lost art. And too many times when we do open our mouths to each other, it's just filled with dysfunction or confusion. You know, I had a hint about something this week, and I thought I'll go ahead and just check it out and see if it's true. I had a hint of what would happen if I Googled, "How do I talk to my," and then left it, just to see what would come up. How do I talk to my, then hit search. And the answers were exactly what I thought they would be. Overwhelmingly family-centric. How do I talk to my teenager? How do I talk to my wife? How do I talk to my in-laws? How do I talk to my parents? How do I talk to my daughter? How do you talk to people in your family? Or more importantly, how should you? Well, when you dig into what Scripture has to say, there's three huge headlines. Three big headlines that's affirmed by every family research study I've ever read. Three things that I would absolutely, die on that hill for in terms of my own experience as a father of four and grandfather of nine. Here are the three big communication headlines about the way it's supposed to work in a family. Family communication should be loving. Family communication should be encouraging. Family communication must be initiating. Let's talk about all three. Beginning with the one that would be obvious, I hope, to most people. When families talk to each other, it should be loving. Jesus gave the most fundamental command for relational life when he said these words, "A new commandment I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another." The expression of love has to be part of the fabric of a family's life. It can be in the simplest of ways. Many years ago, our family started this little thing where we would say to each other, "Have I told you yet today?" And what that meant was, "Have I told you yet today that I love you?" And the answer from the other person was always the same, no. Because we wanted to hear them say it. And all the other person had to say was, I do. I do. Silly, I know. But it meant something to all of us. We also have this sign language thing going on where one of us would look at somebody else and we'd go, I love you. That's all we'd say to each other. I love you. Sometimes it'd be like far away across the room or something. And the other person would say, I love you too. And now we just kind of look at each other and we just kind of go. And everybody thinks, oh, 60s Woodstock family. No, it's just, we know what we're saying. You're saying, this is so basic. I don't need to tell my people are here to be told that I need to say I love you. Maybe you don't. Studies show a lot of you do. I've been up close to some very dysfunctional families. It's kind of an occupational hazard of being a pastor. You kind of get up close to a lot of family breakups and train wrecks. And I've been up close to some of the very dysfunctional families. And you know what is almost always present in the midst of their dysfunction? This claim that there's still love. You know, yeah, I did that or I did that or that. But I mean, they know I love them or I love them. The father will say he loves his daughter. The son will say he loves the mom. The problem is, okay, we need to work on some translation skills. Because that person does not feel loved. And they don't feel like you've ever said you loved them or even shown love to them in like forever. You're not saying it or you're not saying it in a loving way. In fact, you know what's the craziest thing I've heard? People will say, they know I love them. They don't need me to say it. I hardly even have a category for that. What planet were you raised on? Of course people need to hear it. I read a study that found that 42% of today's teenagers failed to hear regular words of praise from their families. Half could not remember the last time they were hugged or kissed. 54%, that's more than half, could not remember when their parents had ever said, I love you. More than half of all teenagers today can't remember when their parents said, I love you. Do a little inventory this week. Just ask yourself, just kind of, and be kind of ruthless with yourself. Just get off quietly to ask yourself, when was the last time you told every person in your family that you loved them? Every person in your family, you love them. Second dynamic when it comes to healthy communication in families is that it should be encouraging. The Bible says, encourage one another and build each other up. And it says, let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Let us encourage one another. Now, the word encourage means to put courage in. In other words, it's the opposite of tearing someone down. It's the opposite of interacting with them in a way that they cower before you in fear or discouragement. When you have a healthy family, you should be built up and strengthened by that family, not torn down. The husband compliments his wife on how she's dressed, or he brags on her latest accomplishment at work or in the home. The wife tells her husband how proud she is of all that he's done with his life and makes it clear how much she respects him as a person. You hear a father tell his little girl what a beautiful picture that was that she drew, and he wants to put it on the refrigerator or frame it, and he tells her how pretty she is and how smart she is and how she is his princess. You hear a mother tell a little boy what a good house he built out of those blocks and how big and strong he is. Is there a part of you just hearing that that makes you yearn for it yourself? Because you never had that growing up. You didn't have a lot of encouragement in your home. There's a reason that even as an adult, you can yearn for that. Listen, while we all have different love languages, when it comes to family life, encouraging words is part of everybody's needed love language. Without exception, because they're so powerful. Words are more powerful than we realize. There's a verse in the Bible that I've gone back to many a time just to reflect on. In Proverbs 18, it says this, words kill, words give life. They're either poison or fruit. Do we think about what comes out of our mouth that way? And that's why harmful language is so detrimental to family life and why the Bible just declares war against harmful language. Let me give you a sampling from the book I just read from Proverbs. Proverbs is a fascinating book. I've often told people that if there's one book you want to read for parenting skills and financial management and a thousand others, practical life issues, just read Proverbs. It's the great wisdom book of the Bible, written by Solomon, who asked God to give him the gift of wisdom, and God said, okay, I'll make you the wisest man ever. And Proverbs is where Solomon recorded his wisdom. Let me just give you a taste of what is in Proverbs on this. Proverbs 10, the mouth of a good person is a deep, life-giving well, but the mouth of the wicked is a dark cave of abuse. Proverbs 12, some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. Proverbs 15, a gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. Again from Proverbs 15, kind words heal and help, cutting words wound and maim. Proverbs 16, kind words are like honey, sweet to the soul, healthy for the body. You get the idea? Here's the principle. Have your words build up, not tear down. Or as the Apostle Paul put it in his New Testament letter to the church at Ephesus, have everything you say be good and helpful so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them. This is so critical to get down because the way families talk to each other can just be awful. The husband turns to his wife and criticizes her mercilessly. She makes little comments that tear away at a sense of self-worth. Mom and dad turn to a child and say, why can't you be like your brother? Can't you ever do anything right? Children turn to their brothers and sisters and say things like, I wish you'd never been born. I hate you. Okay, that's just the tame stuff. That's the tame stuff. I cringe at how some families talk to each other, even to the point of just letting profanity fly. Parents calling their children names that I cannot even imagine calling a child, much less if you're their parent. Can you imagine what it's like for a child to be called a profane name by a father or mother? I can't even imagine what that does. Well, I know exactly what it does. There's nothing more damaging. And I'll tell you what, the way siblings talk to each other, oh my gosh, it's just hateful and cutting and demeaning, and the parent just stands by and lets it happen. It's as if they're not even hearing their kids talk to each other that way. That will tear a family apart. When our kids were little, and they would get mad at each other like all kids do, and maybe say something mean or hurtful or snarky or whatever, we would jump all over it. No matter what was going down or how right they might have been to have gotten frustrated or mad or hurt, we would always say the same thing. We'd intervene, we'd stop it, and we'd say, we don't talk to each other that way in our family. You know, repeat after me. We don't talk to each other that way in this family. Now, we'll sort this out and we'll talk it through, but we're going to do it in a loving way and we're going to do it in an encouraging way, in a way that shows honor and respect to each other. But we don't talk that way in this family, period. And there's all kinds of subtle ways a family can get toxic like this. I remember in our family, one of my natural ways to make a joke is sarcasm. And quite frankly, I can be really good at it. And what I found was that I had a child or two that got really good at it. And sarcasm would fly, and it reached a point where I started to get uncomfortable with it because the sarcasm would contain enough truth at the expense of the person that it really was a cutting remark hid behind a smile. And I remember I had a time where I just kind of called a timeout on it. I said, look, I need to tell all of you, I need to ask your forgiveness. I just need to be so much more careful. I need to pull that whole sarcasm thing back because I think it crossed over to where it was getting hurtful and even demeaning, and it was had too much of a sting to it, and it was belittling more than it was building up. We can tease each other all day long, but we don't tease at their expense. And I said that we just need to clean that up in our family, and we did. You want to know how devastating saying hurtful things can be? Dr. J. Allen Peterson, who was the late director of Family Concern, based on his research and studies, found that for every one negative thing that you say to a family member, and particularly to a parent to a child, for every one negative thing, it takes four positive statements to keep the balance. That's how powerful the negative is. I once read something that drove this home to me. It came from the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific, and it was how villagers there practice a really unique form of logging. If a tree is too large to be felled with an axe, the natives get it down by yelling at it. Woodsmen creep up on a tree at dawn and suddenly scream at it at the top of their lungs. And they do that every morning for 30 days. And then they say the tree eventually dies and falls over. And the theory is that yelling and screaming kills the spirit of the tree. I don't know if that really works on trees or not. I know it works on people. It works on people. Yelling at living things, tearing them down, kills their spirit. But not encouragement. That's what builds them up. That's what breathes life into everybody involved, which means verbal compliments and kind words and words that build up. Encourage them for things they do. Encourage them for who they are. Encourage them in ways that boost confidence. Encourage them in ways that related to self-esteem and self-worth. Speak those words. It's what healthy families do. Well, one last thing about families and communication. It has to be initiated. I don't think this is talked about near enough. How family communication should not be left to itself, to just kind of happen in some serendipitous kind of way. No. Deep conversations, important conversations should be initiated. They should be pursued, planned, developed. I read a study of over 2,000 teenagers that asked them to complete the following sentence. I wish. You know what came out on top? I wish I could talk to my folks about some of my problems. Here's what the study did that I thought was fascinating. They then went to 2,000 parents. They did the same thing. Fill in this sentence. I wish. And the answer came back. I wish I could talk with my teenager about the things troubling him. So if everybody wants to talk to each other, what's the problem? Well, research has found out. The problem is not a secret. Here's what research has found. Parents look to their kids to take the initiative, and they don't. And in response, the parent doesn't take the initiative. Parents waiting on the kid. Kid doesn't make the initiative. Parent writes it off. Oh my goodness. You can't do family that way. More to the point, you can't parent that way. Parents, you've got to take the initiative with your kids to talk to them. They usually don't have the courage or the ability or even the maturity to initiate meaningful conversations, even when they long for it personally. That's our job. I read of one woman who remembered that as a teenager, she wanted desperately to talk to her mother about sex, but she just couldn't get up enough courage to approach her. But she said, if only there had been a word, a lead, an opening on my mother's part, the floodgates of sharing a painful problem would have been released. But that word, that lead, never came. But it should have. It wasn't the responsibility of my children to tell me about their day. It was not the responsibility of my children to tell me about their day. It was not their responsibility to share questions and fears and worries. 9 times out of 10, they didn't even have the ability to be in touch with themselves enough to do it. It was my role to pull it out of them, to help them talk about it, to create opportunities and conversations that would allow that stuff to come out. And it starts young. Don't wait until the teen years. If you wait until then, you've waited too long. The groundwork for open communication has to be laid way before then. And it's not just prepping them for the big talks on sex or drugs or dating. When children are young, they have issues they need to process with you that are every bit as important to them at that age than the issues that they're going to have in middle school or high school or college. I remember when my daughter Rebecca was 7. She was invited to a party by another girl that she really didn't know very well, but she was so excited to be included and invited. So she went and she came home and she said she had fun, and that was that. But she didn't seem to act like her usual self afterward. She wasn't as bubbly about it or as talkative about it or kind of replaying it as much as usual. So I began to poke around and ask questions and ask more details and dig in and dig in, and finally found out that what had happened was that the birthday girl had one particular game. And for whatever reason, at the beginning of the game, she said, "Now everybody can play except Rebecca." And as you might imagine, it just devastated her. And it embarrassed her. And she didn't know how to talk about it. She knew it hurt. She knew she was unhappy. But she didn't know how to talk about feelings of rejection. She didn't know how to talk about low self-image. But she needed to. She needed us to know about it, for us to walk her through it, to wrap our arms around her and tell her she is the most amazing human being on this planet. But it was our job to get her talking, not hers. She was 7. That's our job. And owning the taking of the initiative only gets more critical as that age. You think your kid is going to come to you and say, "Hey, Mom, let's talk about pornography. I got a few questions. Hey, Dad, my boyfriend's pressuring me to have sex. Any pointers?" I don't think that's going to happen. So take the initiative. Help them share what needs to be shared. And one of the best ways to get it going is to share from your own life, to be open yourself. When you share with your child how you were teased as a child — you mean you were teased as a child? Sure, I was teased as a child. You open the door and you give them a way to explore that with you for their own life. When you share about your past dating life, "You know, I remember what it was like on my first date." You know, you open up the door for them to talk about their dating life. You have to take the lead to get to know them. There's an old story that always stood out to me of a rabbi who was sitting in a study, and one of his students came and knocked on the door. And the rabbi let him in, and the student says, "I just want you to know, Rabbi, how much I love you." And the rabbi put down his book and kind of looked over his glasses at him, and he said, "What hurts me?" The student said, "What do you mean?" The rabbi said, "What hurts me?" And the student said, "Well, I don't know." And then the rabbi said, "How can you love me if you don't know what hurts me?" That's a life lesson. Do you know what hurts your child? Do you know what's causing them anxiety? I mean, like right now. What's on their mind? Is it school performance and grades? Is it their looks? Is it friends and how friends treat them? Is it violence and bullying? Is it drinking? Is it the fear of being poor when they get older? Is it sex? It's your job to find out. It's your job to talk to them in a way that discovers it. So, how and when is that going to happen? How and when are you going to have these pivotal conversations? Let's get super practical. This is something I wish someone had told me a long time ago. Let me just give you 6 times that you need to seize to talk to your child. Okay? See if any of these might be useful to you. All 6 were critical for me and Susan and our family. First, dinner time. Families today are on the run. And because they're on the run, they do not interact. And because they don't interact, they don't communicate. There's got to be a place. There's got to be a time, a space created to allow meaningful communication to take place. And one of the best ways to do this is guard your family dinner time as many nights as humanly possible. In her research on the traits of healthy families, based on the work of over 500 family therapists and specialists, Dolores Curran discovered that families who do the best job of communicating make the dinner meal a pivotal, important part of every day. That was what her research found out. What's the key to communication? Dinner time. They don't eat in front of the TV. They don't eat based on their schedules. They've got a time where they all sit down together and they eat. And while they're eating, as well as after they finish, they talk. And if there's a parent in the room who's worth their parenting salt, when they sit down at that table and somebody whips out the cell phone, they take that cell phone and trash it. We're not here for that. And if it's the parent on the cell phone at dinner time, okay. Enough said. I can't even go there. That's precious holy time with your family. It seems like such a simple thing, but it can make a world of difference. Second talk time that matters is when you are taking them to school or you're driving them home from school. At least it was huge for me and Susan. Some of you know that we homeschooled our kids up through eighth grade, and then we had them in a high school that was about a 35-minute drive from our house. And we look back on those drives to and from that school day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, as some of the most pivotal times we had with them. Whenever we were invited into a carpool, we intentionally said no because we wanted that time alone with our kids. And the radio wouldn't be on and they wouldn't have buds in their ears or be on their phones. We talked and we took the lead. How is school? They'd say, fine. That's not an answer. Tell me what made it fine. Walk me through the classes you had today. What were the periods that you had? What happened in each class? And we zeroed in on lunch. Like, well, who did you sit with and what did you talk about? And we wanted to know their world and their friends. Well, the person who said that, what was their name again? Now, Susan did the lion's share of this with them, but I always took at least one day a week just to make sure that there wasn't a week that went by that at least I didn't have one going and coming drive with them so that we could talk. And I would often, on my Fridays, that I'd pick them up. You know, I'd have Starbucks and stuff kind of waiting for them when they got in the car so I could make them in a happy place. And then once I got them there, it was like, you know, loosen their tongues. And here's a little tip. Don't ask questions that can be answered with a single word. Think about that. Don't ask a question that can be answered yes or no. Ask questions that can only be answered in a sentence. How did you feel about your day and what made you feel that way? See what happens. Third talk time is what I'll call room time. This is something I did with my kids that mattered more than I probably realized at the time, just based on feedback I've gotten from them over the years. I would just go and sit in their room. On the floor or on their bed, spend maybe just, but it didn't have to be long, maybe 30 minutes or so when they were in there, and I would just hang out. I would just visit them in their room just to talk, just to catch up. And it would be all about them. If they were listening to music, I would listen to it with them, and I would find out what they liked about it, who the artist was, and have them play me their favorite songs. I would ask about if they put up a new poster or something up. I would ask about that and the pictures on display. And if they had something out that they were reading, I'd ask about what it was they were reading. You know, for most children, particularly as they get older, their room is such an important and intimate expression of who they are, an extension of who they are, and their personality and their world and their interests. Enter into it. More than just physically, enter into their room relationally and engage it. A fourth talk time may surprise you because you may feel like it's one that you should denigrate. No, I think it's one you ought to embrace, make it part of the arsenal, which is email or text time. And as much as it isn't as good as face-to-face conversation, it's how the world communicates and many times how your child might be most comfortable communicating. So we worked really hard to have email and texting be normal between us and the kids, sending each other links or funny videos or articles or updates, making sure that we had that line of communication open. So if you're not texting, get into it. Why? Because your kids are into it. Fifth talk time is what we called in our family Starbucks time. Here's what it's about. There needs to be a time when you intentionally bring things up that you know you need to bring up, and you need to create a time to do it. And so you actually plan it, you craft it, you design it. I've done this what feels like 1,000 times, so has Susan. There would be something that I might be sensing in one of the children, something I was observing, something I felt I needed to address, and I would say, you know, I would even pull Susan aside, I need to have a Starbucks with them on that. And I'm going to make sure I get that in the next week or so. I'll look for a time and try to create it. So maybe I'd have them go out with me on an errand or a run to the mall or something like that. And I said, why don't we run by Starbucks and get something to drink? And we'd go in there and sit down. And during that time, I would, you know, try to find a way to kind of bring it up. And I purposefully chose a setting that was relaxed and neutral and relational, just the two of us. Now, if you say, well, why did you wait? Why didn't you just address it right when you sensed it? Well, because, a little side note, you may not agree, but I found this to be very true. Not all conversations that you need to have to happen right when it comes up. May not even be the time or place, may not even be best. What a lot of parents do is their kid says something or reveals something or they find out something and they instantly react. Boom! And it hasn't been processed and it's often hypercharged with all kinds of adrenaline and emotion. I've had times where my kids have said something that, you know, everything within me, you know, I just wanted to just like erupt or lecture or just, you know, whatever. But I learned that a lot of times the best thing I could do was just, all right, just let me just shut up, you know, and just let me listen and not comment and store it away so they don't shut down on me. And then hear what they had to say and what they felt and what was going on and not pass immediate judgment. And then knowing, but man, this is a Starbucks conversation. So then going back to them and saying, usually this is how I would process it or how I would say it. I'd say, we'd be sitting there talking and I would say, you know, you remember what you said to me the other day? You remember that? Yeah, I've been thinking about that. And I've been praying about that. And can I just share a few things as your father? Just some thoughts and counsel. Man, when it's done that way, you'd be shocked at how wide open they are when it's handled that way. And we've done this so many times, it's just part of our family's culture. Now the kids come up to me and say, hey, Dad, I need a Starbucks. You know, I got something to talk about. Or now these days they're all grown, they say, hey, I need a craft brewery. I'll suffer for Jesus. The final talk time is what I'll call the big talk time. A single event that should take place before puberty at around the age of 12, but certainly between the ages of 10 and 13. Use your judgment based on your kid. For me, I would have these usually during the summer as part of a round of golf. Even with my girls, they didn't like golf like the boys did. They loved the atmosphere of it. They liked to drive the carts and be outside, and they loved the refreshment cart that would come by. So I would take them out for 9 holes. That's about all they had in them. And we'd go to the clubhouse afterward and get a drink, just this relaxed kind of half day kind of thing. And it would be like a Starbucks on steroids because we had spent like, you know, it's like a 3 or 4 hour thing together. And I knew that there was a summer with each one of my kids, usually before 6th grade, when there are things that I really needed to talk to them about as their dad. We need to talk about sex. We need to talk about relationships. We need to talk about dating. We need to talk about peer pressure. We need to talk about everything that was going to face them in a clear, concise, straight-up way that built off of all the dinner conversations and all the room time and all the Starbucks talks that we'd had and all the Starbucks talks we were going to have. And I'll bet you that every one of my kids could tell you about a key conversation or two they had with me over a summer after a round of golf that went really deep. And they were so glad that it was like, oh, to just talk about it, you know, before it was an issue. Now, these are just examples. I think dinner time and room time is for everybody, but Starbucks, golf, that kind of stuff, those are just my deals. You need your own kind of Starbucks conversations and places and your own kind of golf kind of times. It might be camping. It might be on a trip. Susan liked to take the girls out for dessert or tea or pedicures. And one time I took both of my girls to the mountains to a bread and breakfast for a night for a particular conversation that I knew was going to take a little time. But the point is to take time to create these channels of communication and to realize how important it is to make it happen for your family, to prioritize communication in the home, just like we need to prioritize time and to protect it. When I talk to people, I say, okay, you're pretty disciplined with your time. I can pick up on that. You're pretty disciplined in protecting that time. That's really good. How disciplined are you at conserving and protecting your communication energies before you get home? And they almost look at me like a deer caught in headlights. What do you mean, protect and conserve my communication energies? I said, because you probably, like if you're normal, you use 99% of them up before you get home. But when you get home, hey, that's the show. That's the game. And you've already just spent everything. In one of their books, Gary Smalley and John Trent tells of a wife that felt frustrated because of her husband's lack of communication with the family. So to try to explain how she felt, she came up with a story about a man who went to breakfast with some friends, and he ate this huge meal, and then he gathered up some crumbs and put them in a bag. And then he went to lunch with some business associates and ate this huge steak. And again, he put a few crumbs in the bag to take home. And then when he came home that night, he handed his family the little bag of leftovers. And then she said, "That's what you're doing to us. All day, the children and I wait to talk with you when you get home, but you don't share yourself with us. After being gone all day, you hand us a doggy bag and go sit in front of the TV. Don't do it. Come home ready for a full meal to share. That's loving, encouraging, and when needed, initiating." Okay, well, let's stand for a closing prayer. Father, I am so grateful for how the scriptures encouraged me along these lines, and because I didn't have a lot of that fleshed out for me, and nor was I mentored in it, and so this was something that I so needed to go to school on, and I'm so glad. I certainly didn't bat 1,000 by any means, but what few times I did connect with the ball is because it was following these principles. And I pray that all of us here will take to heart whatever it is you wanted to say to us about communication and family. Whatever it was, you just kind of tapped us on the shoulder of the heart and said, "Hey, you listen to this one, you know you need to." And that we wouldn't get defensive, but we would be open about it so that we can have our family life be what it's meant to be. I pray that for all of us in the name of Jesus. Amen.